Welcome to another episode of Can Marketing Save the Planet? And today, Michelle and I are delighted to be joined by Beth Knight, who is Social Impact and Sustainability Director. Beth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleased to be invited. Hi, everyone.
So, Beth, you and I met recently at an IEMA event and got chatting and about all sorts of different things, and you were on a panel there. So can we just start with an introduction to yourself and the work you do for our listeners?
So, as you said, I'm a social impact and sustainability director. I've spent over 15 years of my career working at the intersection of public-private acceleration of business and corporates as a force for good in the world. And what that essentially means is I've been working with large multinationals like Accenture, Ernst & Young, their clients, more recently Amazon, to use their what their business does well to help society and help the planet. And that keeps me busy, unsurprisingly.
Absolutely. I mean, and it is such a broad and all-encompassing range, isn't it? And there is a lot of discussion around ESG and sustainability and business's role within society. But if we focus in on the S for this discussion, it often kind of S for social comes kind of last, or it's missed off altogether, isn't it? And with societal challenges being growing all the time. You know, is it, you know, a case of how do we get businesses to focus in on the S and start to make some positive impacts there?
Yeah, I definitely think there's been less focus, at least from a corporate affairs and marketing perspective, on the S of sustainability. And the environment piece is sometimes easier to understand, although I appreciate there's lots of complexity around that. But with the environment conversation, it's a much simpler thing to understand, in the sense that, you know, the air is polluted, we've got biodiversity loss, there's climate change, etc. And then how do you talk about that and how do you explain that? On the social side of things, it's much more complex. We are all intersectional human beings. We have different identities. We have intergenerational, cross-border complexities in how our society functions. And when you think about the role that community has, even that word and the use of that word is kind of shifting in how it's understood in our society. Particularly in the last 3 years, there's been a real acceleration in how companies are engaging with that S, the social impact conversation. And I think I'm right in saying, at least from a European business context, that a lot of businesses are making big strides in this space. And we can see it kind of on the regulatory side of things as well. There's all these different kind of levers and critical changes in the wider system that are causing businesses to really step up and engage with what their social impact in the world is.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that community aspect, this human aspect, when we think about people, planet, as well as profit, you know, there is this big people component to the triple bottom line, that community aspect, the affected communities that businesses are affecting. And again, there's that regulation around those elements. But it's an enormous kind of opportunity, isn't it, for organizations that aren't focused in on that area, because there are many different aspects to the social element. I mean, you mentioned a few there, but if we can just dive in a little bit more about all the different complexities of the social side, not all of them, because this, you know, we probably wouldn't have time for the whole
podcast.
Exactly. But the opportunities for business around engaging with that social element, because as you say, the environmental piece is complex but clearer, particularly about what they're communicating about, what they're doing and understanding those elements. And the governance piece is the governance piece. And there seems to be lots of comfort levels around that. But the social aspect from a communications perspective about what organizations are doing as well, there's this missed opportunity.
Let me make an attempt at simplifying it, and maybe you and Gemma can tell me how I do, Michelle. So I think the term that you said there, which is affected communities with an A, affected. Now, that's the language that you'll find in ESRS regulation coming in through the European Union. And it's having a knock-on impact for any businesses that have got supply chain workforce impact through that region. Essentially, what affected communities means is any communities that are impacted by you running your business. And that might be your domestic footprint, i.e. Where your buildings and sites are based, the people that live in and around where you're running your business. It might be communities that are affected by your supply chain. So raw materials or products that are in your supply chain that are impacting people. And things like the cocoa and the coffee supply chain, they're kind of more easily understood. The fashion supply chain is a big one that we have lots of conversations around now. But it is something that is pertinent to all. And so therefore, companies understanding which communities are impacted most by how I run my business. Am I creating equity through the way that I'm running my business wherever possible? What is the role of business and what's the intersection between that role of business, civil society and government in order to make sure that people can live sustainable livelihoods, that we have social mobility within our society so that people can make their lives better and care for their families, etc. So that's sort of the outwards in definition. And then there's the more kind of internally focused, what's the company's purpose? What's the culture of the organization? Yeah. How does that manifest in how it shows up, how it treats its employees? It's great if you can say, I've got an equal pay audit for gender or race or whatever lens the company is choosing to put on it. But if there's a dark side metric that offsets that light side metric, you're risking kind of purpose wash or spin. And so what you don't want from a marketing perspective is somebody out there going, this is great, we're doing all these wonderful things. But we've also got, you know, rising cases of whistleblowing, strong examples of complaints or employee relations issues are on the rise, or we've got tools like TalkWalker, sentiment monitoring, and the local communities around where we work feel like we are, taking jobs away from local people or shifting the kind of economic base in the locations that we're working within. Or, you know, worst case scenario, you've got scrutiny where your supply chain has really significant risks, where you're seeing things like human rights breaches or issues with child labour in your supply chain. So it's that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because from a marketer's perspective, they generally focus on talking outwards to their customers and to the communities in front of them who they think they're going to engage with their products. And there's not really much looking back, as you say, inwards at what's happening at that social side through supply chains and the other people within the organization, which all build up a really strong story around social, isn't it? So How do we think we should can advance some of those conversations and communications so that people are more aware of what's happening all around them, as opposed to just that forward-facing lens of these are our customers, this is how we segment them, this is what we're going to tell them about and how we do it? I mean, there's a much broader, more interesting story, isn't there, if they have a much broader understanding of what that S encompasses?
Yeah, and I mean, the marketeer's role in owning the narrative is really important. So helping the company to explain what they're doing, i.e. how their product is adding value to society or the environment, etc., is very important and kind of bringing that brand to life. But we're also living in an age now where that isn't completely within the control of marketeers, right? And so you're seeing rises in employee activism, particularly in large multinationals. You know, we've seen this at Amazon, we've seen this at Vodafone, different companies where if employees don't feel that the company is doing all that it can around a particular subject, they will kind of vocally share their voice and share what they're showing on the inside. And so that relationship between marketeers and internal communicators within companies is very important. The ability to create 360 feedback loops where you can actually listen so that you're not in a position of spin or green wash, purpose wash, green hush, purple wash, whatever yeah. wash yeah. anyone's getting accused of putting on things. And also there's a real rise, at least in multinationals anyway, in the use of kind of data and sentiment monitoring to really understand perception of a brand and the perception of a product. And so the way in which companies are understanding, are we doing well? It's not necessarily linked to just one campaign or how one key message is landing anymore. It's increasingly around the kind of complete full health of how a company is understood to be sustainable.
Yeah.
It's a much broader conversation, isn't it?
It's got to be a constant
conversation that just happens and becomes embedded in the culture of how you communicate what you do, don't you? Isn't it?
And I think the scary thing is it's the type of thing where you get it wrong. If you're then operating from a place of brand deficit and having to kind of rebuild from that, it's exceptionally challenging for marketeers. So kind of making sure that you understand the materiality assessment of a company, the social impact indicators within that materiality assessment, so that you know what the hotspots are from a social lens around this is what could be an issue for the company. It's the challenges that the company is having to get its arms around. And then as a marketeer, helping the company and having a plan around that on how you're going to proactively engage either consumers, customers, key stakeholder groups on those social topics is something that shouldn't be missed.
Yeah. And this is new for marketers. I mean, not always, because I mean, you have often in internal comms, you will have the team that are looking at risks and they're looking at the kind of reputation management and risk reduction of those communications and those things that are happening. But that's largely in, as you said, multinationals that are kind of over this or concerned about those risk elements and brand elements. And they may have whole teams kind of geared up for some of those things, not just about sustainability, but sometimes around the health and safety aspects, and depending on which industry they're in. But what about smaller organizations and marketers that are working for SMEs that effectively are faced with these same challenges around not really understanding or it never being part of their remit to go inwards, to look at the social aspect, to look at some of those supplier relations or indeed those affected communities and those elements that it's not often, you know, the marketers are not often part of that conversation.
Yeah, and it's particularly tricky, right, because you cannot expect somebody to be a complete expert in everything. None of us can. It's just not humanly possible that, you know, we would risk insane levels of burnout if that was the expectation. I think there are some real cheeky hacks, shall we say, that you can use to help us now. Yes, so I would look at large competitors working in the industry that you're in. And I would look at their materiality assessments and the social indicators that they're across. I would look at where your company is headquartered and what the corporate governance structures are there. Because within, for example, in the Companies Act in the UK, there are very specific things that the company needs to disclose around its impact on the community. I would also look at something called a B impact assessment, Benefit corporations do those. I'm not expecting every SME to become a B Corp, but the impact assessment itself, which is free and you can kind of go through the tool, provides a really helpful diagnostic on where the company has amazing strengths, i.e. the things you want to shout about, cheerlead, and then areas where the company needs to improve. And I think knowledge and understanding then will inform a marketeer to understand what is, i.e. safe, leading practice, good to talk about, and then other areas which you might want to avoid or have a mitigation or crisis response plan around in case they happen. There's also sentiment monitoring tools around. So depending on the complexity of the company's supply chain, depending on the level of investment, any large companies with a revenue of over, let's say, 10 million, I would expect them to be doing some form of sentiment monitoring. Any company that's smaller than that, probably it's just social listening at this stage. And it would be using AI tools like Google Gemini have an LLM AI tool where you can literally just type into that, what are the largest social impact issues impacting my business in this sector, in this location, and it will probably throw back a high-level summary of things that you need to be mindful of.
Because it's interesting, you said no one can be an expert in all of these things. I think it's just about how do you become a little bit more aware, isn't it, of a full-rounded awareness of things as opposed to just focusing on profit and revenue and growth. We've got to pull back from this, haven't we, and start looking at that broader piece. In terms of talking about, you know, where you're doing well, where you'll have positive social impacts, I know many companies would shy away from this, but do you think we need to talk a little bit more about where we're not doing so well and that journey through that piece and help each other as people, as businesses, as industries navigate how we can improve there? And I know people shy away from talking about failures and the, you know, the negative, but I think that there is something that can come from that, isn't there?
I think I think in humbleness and integrity in communications is really important. Owning that a mistake has happened or there's been an issue that's occurred within the organisation is important. But also I would say it's not enough just to say we've messed up over here. Right. It's a case of this has happened. We've learned from it. We are therefore doing X, Y, Z. So I think that's about protecting brand to an extent. Yes, profits are important, but you know, profits are put at risk if your customers and consumers don't believe in what you're doing and what you stand for. And then I think it's a case of judging whether it's timely in the market or not. The social conversations can be extremely tricky to navigate. And we've seen this recently. I'll use a difficult example, but the example of Gaza and how some companies have responded in different ways to that humanitarian crisis because of the political and religious sensitivities to it. There was many companies kind of came out and wanted to show support for humanitarian reasons because of the atrocities and the genocide that's going on there. But it would be wrong to say that that isn't something that is polarizing large elements of society, and so there's a risk in that, and needing to have an informed opinion to go out and talk about something that is contentious. It divides people. It's important to not just rush out and say things for the sake of saying them. Oh, something's occurred. I need to have a position on it. If it affects your business, then yes, you do need to have a position on it, but also it's something that you needs to be kind of measured, considerate of your full customer base, considerate of both sides of an argument. And there are examples out there of where companies got that very, very wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier about, you know, it's not a single campaign, you know, in terms of how we talk about the S in ESG and the social side. So can we just kind of turn our focus a little bit to cause and market social marketing, because I believe that, sure, you know, social marketing certainly is making a comeback, and it's usually associated, you know, with health and safety and drink drive campaigns and smoking and obesity. But it's a really, really good way for driving both sustainability and commercial objectives, isn't it?
Yes, I think the biggest success that we've actually ever had from an environmental perspective, some people might disagree with me here, but if you think back to when we were a bit younger than we are now, and CFCs were really topical. So we were losing the ozone layer, and aerosols were causing a huge amount of damage. And it was a exceedingly complex space because not one company controlled that technology, not one national government could solve the issue or the problem, and ultimately what was required was change at the level of government regulation, companies actually even using the product and the technology, waste distributors taking back in those aerosol cans that were causing the ozone holes, and civil society, people stopping using them. And so that's a great example of a social campaign where at all levels in society, particularly Western society globally, where most of these were being used, we mobilized around that. And marketeers and companies explained to consumers why they should stop using them. Governments regulated them. There were ads on the TV. Children in school were understanding it and they were going home and informing their parents. And ultimately, we were able to protect that ozone layer. We carved back and stopped using something that was damaging, and it is now repairing itself. It's a great success story, and really, it's a marketeer success story, right? Mm. So that for me is phenomenal. There's other examples of social campaigns that get things slightly wrong. There was quite a there's one that's used a lot at Cambridge University, where I teach sustainability. That there was a famous poster of a Native American in a canoe around some mountains with loads of litter around them, crying. And for a million reasons, there was bad reactions to this campaign. The use of an Indigenous person with litter around them was uncomfortable for many people. The behavioural science around when people see a place that's littered, actually it doesn't encourage them to pick up litter. The behavioural response is that more people actually litter. And what they need to see are images of clean, green areas, diverse groups of people, and images of a utopian nice world that we want to protect and nurture, etc. And so yes, I think social marketing is extremely important, and I think that this is sort of what we mean around being educated around what the message should be, what the images should be, how to get this right, and what the audience needs to see and hear and understand in order to effect a change in action.
Yeah, because that psychological element is absolutely critical, isn't it? There's a number of studies, we mentioned them a number of times in our book, around that Brand Genetics did, around what will engage people, what will make people kind of move away and absolutely reject those elements, you know, become disgusted by some of those images, etc. So we have to, as marketers, like you say, understand those elements. But also, what about the business case around the S side and the social impact side? One of the things that is often, from a marketing perspective, is of course the metrics that we are focused on are growth metrics. These are metrics around we're moving into a new territory, we're driving more sales and more profitability in one way or another. Where do we need to, or how can we be considering, I mean, obviously risk and reputation, sentiment analysis, some of the data around those elements is going to be potentially some metrics that marketers focusing on social impact can look at. Are there other examples that you have, Beth, about how social impact is effectively measured to support the business case for let's do more in this arena?
Yeah, I mean, yes, there is. And you can look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and there's a raft of key performance indicators under there that you can kind of take, and you just take the subset of those that are most important to your business and your products. So all of the like data points are out there and they exist. And the sophistication here is knowing which ones are most important. And actually, the most sophisticated marketing dashboards on this stuff are the ones that have fewer metrics, but the right ones.
Yes.
So it's
agree.
Not about how much.
No.
And it's not about death by reporting. It's literally it's sophistication of what are the force multipliers for both reputation, social and or environmental good, and then, you know, profit maximization in that context. There's a good book as well by a gentleman called Raj Sisodia. It's called Firms of Endearment, and that's done at a very high level. Those companies that have strong environmental, social and governance performance are proven out through data on the stock exchange that their revenues follow at 14 times in some cases, particularly in FMCG sector. If you can get the marketing right and the brand reputation right, the revenues and the customers follow. So I think that's particularly kind of critical and important. At a macroeconomic level, the other thing to just be super mindful of is one of the myths that we have is that the population is increasing. Actually, at a global level, our population isn't really increasing. In many cases, it's decreasing. And there's a shift now in understanding of that. The middle class is rising at an exponential rate, and consumers in parts of the world like Asia, India, Africa are having more disposable income. Mm-hmm. So how we are marketing from a social lens is changing because the mix of consumers are changing at pace. Those who are able to use their disposable income to even have it to start with is rising, and that's a good thing. But with that, that's also generating overproduction. It's feeding this kind of consumption machine. And there's a direct correlation between social and environmental indicators in that context. So again, that role of a marketer in marketing just to a different demographic, a new set of consumers coming through, helping individuals sit comfortably with the shifts and the change that are around them. It's quite a divisive thing in sustainability circles because some people believe that we need to consume less in Western economies. I think we need to consume differently, would be my view. And so
that's the whole degrowth element.
Yeah, I think so. And circular economy and this sort of thing. And so understanding in a wider macroeconomic context, literally within the next 5 to 10 years, where degrowth is on the rhetoric, there are, you know, more elections happening around the world right now than ever before. Mm-hmm. The level of education around people understanding their rights and what they want to do, both in their interaction with government and private business, is improving. And you've got to run a business in amongst all of that. And, you know, part of that is making money to pay your staff, deciding what you're going to do with any investments that you're putting back into your supply chain, etc. And all of that is something that you've got to hold at a strategic level within the organisation.
So who do you think, in your opinion, is driving the S well? Who's doing well in terms of organisations with the social side?
I think there's really helpful ways to judge this. So the firstly, the health of the organization in terms of its diversity. So I always use the word diversity with a small d because I hate putting labels on people and tick boxes and buckets. But I think that if you have a brand and a company where there is true diversity of thought at the top of an organization, diversity of experience and cultures, that tends to translate very well. You also see that those companies which have a legacy of family business or multi-generational wealth, they tend to be very well performing on the S of ESG because they are likely to have a view of legacy and have been growing up and building out and within those communities. An example of a company I like to use actually is a British chocolate company called Cadbury's. And that's not just because I like chocolate. But what they've done around, firstly, they've got a really strong history of philanthropy and what they've done in Bourneville, in the first kind of wave of industrial revolution that company went through. More recently, how they've been engaged with the cocoa supply chain and the work that they're doing there. Difficult conversations that they've had with investors and being willing to kind of go there from a conversation point of view with people that are kind of in a financial position to influence the growth of their organization. And then how they're engaging with, at the moment, things like eco-labeling, as an example, to show that they've got good practices in place in their supply chain in a way that their customers can understand it. Now, there's also other stuff going on that's going to impact both retailers and these sorts of brands like a Cadbury's or our fashion brands, which is something called dynamic digital product pass passports. Sorry. Yeah. DDPPs. Yes. I'm trying to get the acronym right. I think I'm correct in saying that the UK, just as an example, has 42 different eco-labelling brands that companies have got to get their head around, right? So, like, one surefire way of saying, oh, you know, we're doing good here with our product is have a label that you can, like, smack on the side of it, and that, you know, that's a sign of credibility. Dynamic digital product passports, when they're brought in, are going to be QR codes that go onto products. Food, fashion being the two big ones that will be impacted by that, right? And that will mean that consumers that are engaged will be able to scan those codes and understand the exact impact that product has from an environmental and social perspective. They'll be able to understand if there's any risk of child labour in the supply chain. They'll be able to understand if the product is coming from Bangladesh or an area that's impacted by past crisis, like the Rana Plaza issue that happened there and the subsequent Bangladesh Accord. And not all consumers are going to be educated around that or even want to look at those codes. But the fact that they exist shows a real shift. The data that will sit underneath those, to Michelle's question earlier, they will be the key performance indicators that companies have to know and care about from a data perspective.
Yeah.
And then it's the role of the marketeer to build a narrative around that, to explain to the customer, consumer, investor what that actually means.
Yeah, I was going to just say there's a big opportunity there that you say that not everybody's going to necessarily scan them and want to read the information behind them, but I think there's an opportunity for marketers and communicators there to actually build a story up around what those digital passports are and what the information means behind them, because that's kind of a gateway into this broader education that we do need to, as society, as people, as individuals, start taking a bit more responsibility for our choices in what we consume and how we eat and how we heat our energy we use and how we travel. So I think, you know, having that as a gateway, and but first stepping back and going, right, how do we start talking about these digital passports in a way that they actually mean something? Otherwise, they kind of become a bit redundant, don't they, if they're actually engaging with them when there's a whole world that sits behind there that's really important to humanity and the planet.
See, I think you're right. And this is, I really think you've hit on something there, because there's a risk that this just becomes like another barcode.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Which the average consumer is just like, there's a barcode, bothered. The company worries about that. And it's the role of the retailer.
It's kind of tick box it again, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's the retailer will worry and care about that. The government will do that, so I don't have to as a consumer.
Yeah.
And actually, I think what we're seeing, particularly in the social space, actually, no, also in the environmental, is that we need consumers to self-educate, because that we need the pressure in all parts of the system in order to affect the change that we need to protect our planet, to give everybody a fair shot in life, etc. So that might be the next big social marketing challenge, which is, you know, how do we help consumers understand that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, because it's become like, you know, you see the traffic light system on foods. And to be honest, how many people genuinely take note of, you know, that now? It almost, everything becomes almost subliminal. You see it, and unless you're on a diet or unless you're trying to change something you particularly want to change, don't really look for those things, do you? So I think that, yes, that could be a great social campaign for businesses, for industries, and then you can really see who's doing well and who needs to, that pressure then starts to land on those organizations that aren't doing well. And it's public, you know, it's open to investors to look at, it's open to consumers to look at, it's open to employees to look at, maybe when, you know, they're looking at who they go and work for, because this whole sort of talent acquisition and retention of the best people in your businesses is really, is what business cares about, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a point we keep coming back to, actually, just on the podcast, about where does this meet the consumer, and how is the consumer involved in or educated, or how do we make it easy for them? Because we know that there is appetite from the consumer side to say, we want to do more. We want to be more sustainable. We want to make the right choices. But it's not always clear and evident that they are making the right choices, because they're bamboozled with, you know, labels that, what do those labels mean? They have to get to the QR code and then go in. And some people will do that, you know, maybe 15%, but that kind of big percentage in the middle, that 70% that, you know, are saying they want to do something about it. Are they going to get their phones out in the supermarket and actually start scanning away before they make the choice? And we also interviewed another organization. They've changed their brand name now, but they were talking about a score, just having a score, you know, something, trying to get it to something really quite simple that consumers could understand around what that particularly means from a sustainability perspective, whether it's a happy face or a smiley face or some kind of simple code that genuinely says this is an authentic product that is sustainable and is doing something in the right way. It's not greenwash. It is authentically the right choice for you to be making. Simplifying that is the challenge, isn't it?
It very much is. And I had a conversation recently. I had the pleasure of meeting the CEO of Mulberry, and this is going to tell you now what an absolute nerd I had, but we had an interesting exchange around tanneries, because there's a score rating on leather, around the sustainability of leather, and tanneries. And tanneries are perceived to be extremely polluting, and the scoring on those are low, and it immediately would bring down your kind of product. Let's say the Mulberry handbag score would immediately go down. Yeah. But it's because the scoring in the tannery industry is led by car manufacturing, and the treatment of leather in car manufacturing is heavily plasticized. The tanneries are more likely to be in certain parts of the world where there's less kind of regulation and protection around pollution and labor rights, etc. Whereas the tanneries that are luxury and boutique organization like Mulberry are using, those tanneries are more likely to be in developed world, stricter controls, having, you know, their sustainability scores on their tanneries are world leading. And yet, because of the way that the wider kind of measurement system works, and it's a bit of a cottage industry, let's just own that fact, immediately that is shifting the optics from a consumer perspective on the leather that they can share and disclose as Mulberry. And so in order for them as a company to talk about that stuff and engage with it, they have to have a conversation around, this is what our company's supply chain looks like. This is how we have to educate not just consumers, but also regulators, the people that are creating measurements and labels. This is the legacy of our business. This is who we employ. This is why we employ them. We've made conscious decisions to work with tanneries that do X, Y, and Z. And so it's a sophisticated conversation to be had, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, I love the percentage that you just shared. I totally reiterate that 15% value a lot. And it's consistently true in all of the academic research and literature that I read. 15% of consumers, and I fall into that 15% bucket, are the ones that will use those DDPPs, that will look at the traffic lights. I have a food switch app on my phone. I went through my online shop and I switched out all my regular ordering products to ones that were more sustainable. Yep. And the technology app enabled me to do that. The challenge for us, if those listening, similar to myself, believe this to be true, that we need to help be a force for good as marketers, we don't need to necessarily reach the 70%. We need to reach the 30%. And the real challenge is shifting from 15% of the consumer base engaging with positive social and environmental impact behaviours to 30%. Because data and the science, the behavioural science shows us that if we get 30%, that's when we get to tipping point.
Yes.
And that's when nudge behaviour and herd mentality shifts in.
Yeah, accelerate.
And accelerates. And then mass consumer behaviour tends to follow.
Yeah.
And so that is where the superpower of the marketeer comes in, because you can have the best product in the world, you can have the best measurements in the world, but if your communication is not right, if you don't understand your audience, if you can't shift the dial from 15 to 30%, then you're not shifting mass engagement with that product. You're not taking market share with something that is good and better for the planet than other competitors might have.
So there's our number, guys. There's our number. That's where we need to focus, because there are other narratives that say, oh, you only need to get 5% of the population taking an action, and that's going to swing it in. But actually, it is going from that 15% to 30% that is going to drive that herd mentality, and then accelerate what we do and everything
when
else.
When you're talking about mass consumer change, and you're talking about social marketing, etc., then yes. If you're talking about, you know, like luxury goods or celebrity influencers, then 5% it probably is accurate. But that's not the conversation that we're having right now. So I think that's important to kind of frame that.
Agreed.
Yeah. And do we know what the information is going to be presented like behind these when you scan that QR code? Because that's also a really critical piece. Because if you scan that QR code and it comes up like how we talk about carbon and scopes, then people are just not going to engage with it, isn't it? So there's almost that role there of how is that information going to be presented, and who's having those conversations around that? And if they can't present it any other way because of the complexities of it, because of given the amount of information that needs to be there, then somebody, this gives the argument that sustainability teams and marketing teams need to get together and work together on, well, how do we talk about what is important and what those things mean behind those QR codes?
And translating it. I often see marketers as the kind of translator of, this is really complex. This is really complex sustainability facts and data and all of those elements. But we now need to translate that and meet our audiences where they are at.
Make it relatable to them so they can relate it to their lives, but also know it's easier, isn't it? Because there's sustainability reports on many organizations' websites, but people don't read them and go, oh no, I get that and I understand that. And then
they're talking to me,
This is in danger if we don't grab this now and make sure that it comes out in the right way so that we can talk about it properly and it becomes a really useful mechanism to drive that S and the years.
I mean, my view on this is the most sophisticated companies are probably the ones that don't even necessarily have sustainability reports. Yeah. They'll have a materiality assessment, which is published on the website. They'll have a narrative around the indicators which are most important to them. That will come within the strategy of the company, within how they talk about their brand and their purpose as an organization. And it will just be part and parcel of like integrated reporting annually for the company. And some companies are going through a phased engagement with this, i.e. oh, we'll do a sustainability report and then maybe we'll put it in the annual report and maybe we'll have an investor lens or maybe we'll have a slip sheet or whatever. Okay, but you're making it more work for yourself than it needs to be. You're making it cumbersome. Like, just look at your purpose of your organization, look at your brand, embed it within the DNA of that, look at how you're talking about your products, embed it. Just make it part and parcel of like day doing of work, rather than an additional overhead, you know.
And something that sits on the side, you know, this is just fully integrated into the heart and soul of the business, right? This is what we do. This is how we operate. This is just part and parcel of everything that we do. And this is how we talk about it. Yeah. So goodness, we could go on and on, Beth, and I've got so many questions for you. No doubt we'd love to get you back on the podcast in a future time. But we like to ask each of our guests to wrap up the podcast the same three questions. And so our first question to you is, can marketing save the planet? The namesake of our podcast.
Yes.
Yes.
Perfect. And what do you hope business looks like in 10 years' time?
I hope that business in 10 years' time, every employee can articulate their role of their business in helping make society a better place. And the example that I like to use for that is the story around NASA, where a cleaner was asked in the building, what's your job? And the cleaner replied, my job is to help send someone to the moon. Now, wouldn't it be amazing if everyone operating within business could describe the role of their day job in that context, whatever that might be. And that for me would be the magical role of the marketer in that context.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are organisations doing that, but everyone doing that would just be super, super, super powerful. And if you were to give one piece of advice to marketers around driving the S, or indeed businesses around driving the S side in their sustainable and business agendas, what would that be?
Would be read your materiality assessment. Get under the hood of the social challenges that your company needs to have a strategy around and a point of view around. Mm-hmm. And really use your skill as a marketer to use words properly and appropriately. I think words are extremely powerful in this context, but they are also sometimes dangerous because in the social side of things, you're also putting labels on people, products, etc.
Amazing. Well, Beth, where can our listeners find out more about your work and yourself and follow you?
Well, you're very welcome to connect on LinkedIn. I've also got a website, which is bethknight.earth. So you can find a little more about me and my career on there.
Fantastic. We will make sure all of those links are in the show notes. We'll also link to the B Impact assessment resource that you mentioned as well, because it is a terrific resource as a free tool, completely anonymous tool as well. So a free tool, and there's a short version and a longer version, isn't there? So you can do a kind of short, quick analysis and then or deeper dive. And I agree, it's a very useful assessment tool. It's almost like a gap analysis. This is where we are now. This is where we want to get to. And what are we thinking about or what aren't we thinking about? So we'll make sure that that is included as well.
Thank you for joining us. And we look forward to catching up with you on a future episode.
Thank you for tuning in to the Can Marketing Save the Planet podcast. We hope that you're enjoying these conversations just as much as we are. And if you are enjoying them, then please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast channel, and indeed to share the podcast with your colleagues, your friends, your family, because the more people we can get engaged in these conversations, the better. You'll find the podcast on all the usual podcast platforms, and you'll also find it on the Marketing Society podcast and the Global Player. For more information about the podcast and indeed the work we do, please visit www.canmarketingsavetheplanet.com. There you will find information about our latest books. You'll find information about our online sustainable marketing training hub and the training and advisory services that we offer. And you'll also find our Learning Zone, which is an absolute resource hub filled with all things sustainable marketing. So we look forward to hearing more from you, and we look forward to catching up soon.